the Special Committee on Oil and Gas. It is about 6 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, April 5th. And we have with us this morning Representative Guest, Representative Dyson, Representative Coring, and Vice Chair Fate. This morning, we're pleased to have with us Mark Myers, the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Wilson Conlon, the Commissioner of Revenue. And when I came in, it might be noticed that they were having some discussion as to who was to lead off. And I offered them a quarter to do a little flipping, and they declined. So we'll go by the agenda. And this morning, we will have the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, Mark Myers, to give us some overview on the oil and gas incentives. So with that, Mark, come up.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, and committee members. Thank you again for the opportunity to discuss our programs. We've got a series of handouts. I think probably the most significant one is the first handout that shows kind of a spreadsheet of the various programs. So I'll walk through kind of in the order that are on the spreadsheet. And if you look at our programs, I'm basically going to talk about 9 different programs this morning that the state has that we consider incentive programs, one of which is repealed in 69, Discovery Royalty, but is still very active. And we'll go through, basically discuss the concepts behind the programs, and then try to go back and take a step back and see how they've been administered and what the fiscal impacts of the programs have been over time. So some of your other handouts address size, scale, scope of the program, and how they've been used. I think when you look at our programs in general, you'll find there are incentive programs that start out pre-lease sale that support the gathering of scientific and geological, geophysical data, all the way to programs that support or try to stimulate leasing activity or licensing activity, to programs that give incentives or dollar incentives for exploration wells, to programs that reward discoveries in terms of reduced royalty or taxes, to programs that are designed in royalty reduction to prolong the life of fields or to get fields that have been delineated yet not yet discovered online. And then finally, there are under discovery royalty ability to lower royalty rates to enhance fields that are shut in. So if you look at our 9 programs and the 8 currently existing programs, they sort of cradle the grave in what they work on. Another thing to keep in mind, and what this spreadsheet tries to accomplish, is not all these programs are strictly limited to state lands. And they're varying programs and varying options depending on whether it's a lease or a license, unleased state lands, and federal private land. So this spreadsheet, which was requested actually by Senate Resources initially, sort of tries to capture a lot of that on there. Also, in there's a bit of a discussion about some of the pending legislation that would either extend programs or add additional programs. And I won't go into that today. But so I'll start out with the exploration incentive credits. Basically, this comes in 2 different flavors. A program that's been in existence for a long time is designed to work primarily with our competitive lease sales. And the thought on this program was we wanted to incentivize the drilling of exploration wells. So prior to a competitive sale, the commissioner has the option to set a term that says the state will pay up to 50% of the costs of exploration wells, or in some cases it could actually put the credit on geophysical work conducted within 2 years of the competitive sale. The concept here was it was not discretionary after it was granted with the lease sale, but and had to be administered, but it was discretionary on the commissioner as a term prior to the competitive sale. So you might have a competitive North Slope lease sale and say, under this sale, these leases get a 30% exploration credit. The thought was it was somewhat some reciprocity that would reflect higher bonus bids that might cover actually some of the costs of giving the EIC. The program has not been used by a commissioner in setting lease terms since 91, but it's still available to the commissioner. If you look on the next page, it shows that over the life of the program, 20 EICs have been granted for exploration wells. So you list the wells, shows the dollar amount. So the total amount expended on this program in terms of credits, and these are credits against production, against royalty, against bonus bids, and they are transferable, has been almost $55 million. one of the challenges under this program was the state had to go back and audit what are legitimate expenses and what were not. So you can see some footnotes about this amount was the initial amount. There have been some reduction in this amount due to audits and settlements based on I'm looking at it. But typically, under this program, the state actually paid a substantial part of the cost of the exploration well in hand. So again, 20 wells have been granted this credit. We currently do not put it on our area-wide sales as a term, but it's still within the commissioner's discretion. The second EIC program...
Mark, before you start, I just want to acknowledge that Representative Chenault is also present here with us. Thank you.
And the second exploration incentive program is under AS 4109-010, and that is a program that expires in 2004, but under current legislation sponsored by Representative Fate and I think other members of this committee, which is now currently in the Senate, would extend that credit to 2007. And that exploration incentive credit was designed for unleased state lands or private lands. Under that program, the state could grant up to 50% of the drilling and seismic costs for wells primarily designed to get geologic data. The state would use that program in order to help it evaluate areas, to stimulate exploration for stratigraphic test wells or wells that were drilled specifically to find geologic information but not oil. The thought was in frontier areas in Alaska, maybe a company prior to a competitive sale would want to go out and get baseline information to figure out what it wanted to bid in an area. And typically that would be done by a consortium of companies. They would share the risk and share the data. The state wanted the ability to participate in such activities or stimulate such activities, which would then get the state information it wouldn't normally get, which it would normally get in a lease, but not necessarily on unleased private or native-owned lands or on unleased state lands. So that said, this bill was primarily designed for special conditions to acquire additional either geophysical or geologic data. The program is capped at $30 million for the life of the program. An individual project is eligible for up to $5 million in expenses. So this is an existing program. This program has had two applications under it, one in which the state granted a credit for seismic data in NPRA, which it normally wouldn't have been entitled to, of 18% to Anadarko. They declined the credit because under the program, the state has the ability to show that seismic data to third parties. The company, based on that, decided not to actually take the credit. The second application, the state denied it was for geochemical data in an area where the state had good seismic data and felt it didn't need the data. So at this time, the program is has yet to be used. There is obviously interest in folks in using this program in the future. So that, again, expires in 2004. The current legislation would extend that to 2007 and a $30 million cap on the program. The next program I'll talk about is royalty reduction. And I know royalty reduction is a very, very complex issue. So I'll try to walk you through some briefing slides that you have here that talk about the program in general. So it basically allows the commissioner to modify royalty terms for production that wouldn't otherwise be economically feasible. And there's three components to it. One is fields that are not yet in production, but are fully delineated. In other words, we understand what's there, but you can't make a go of it. And possibly if reducing the royalty can be demonstrated to show that it will, in fact, get the shut-in production into the shut-in field into production. If it's the actual factor that will do that, the commissioner has the ability to lower the royalty. The second is, if you have a field, generally fairly late in its life, where the economics of the field are declining, the number of the production from the field is declining. Rather than see that field shut in, the state has the ability to reduce its royalty in that case to extend the life of that field. And there's really, the typical case you'd use this is late in the life of the field, but there's no requirement to be late in the life of the field. Prior to amendment in 1995, the statute required 2 years of production as a standard prior to granting it to, in this case. So now that's been changed and there's not a two-year standard. The final is to deal with shut-in production. If a field is late in its life and it's actually physically shut in, the state then has the ability to lower the royalty to try to start the production again. And on the next slide, just again, shows that the fields not yet in production have a royalty floor of 5%. So typically our 12.5% royalties can be reduced down to a minimum of 5%. The next is under B, the producing fields. The royalty floor is lower. It's down to 3%. And then finally, for shut-in fields, it's 3%. Now, when the legislature passed the law in 95, they put some clear standards into the royalty reduction. One is it must be clear and convincing that the evidence, the relief, is in the state's best interest. And also that on cases where commodity prices change, technology change, production profiles change, that the field is economic without the relief, the state is able to recover the cost of that. So it was designed to provide some symmetry to recover those losses. And that's an important element of the program. The state under the program requires a significant amount of economic data to do this sort of analysis, production forecasts, data on costs, development costs, et cetera. It needs that information in order to understand and to develop this mechanism. So, in summary, royalty reduction is very complex. It takes a very detailed analysis. And one thing that we have determined over the life of the various royalty reduction programs is it's very difficult. There's a very really narrow range of outcomes where the royalty reduction actually changes the entire economics of the field, a go or no-go decision, et cetera, or actually prolongs the economic life of the field. No doubt those conditions exist, but demonstrating them takes a fair amount of data. And one of the reasons for that is if you're reducing a royalty from 12.5% to 5%, it's about changing it equivalent to a dollar per barrel price in oil. So we see these large fluctuations in the price of oil that certainly exceed that. And those often have a bigger effect on the impact on the field than than would a royalty reduction. So again, there's a narrow band. You can certainly design a mechanism that works within that band, and such mechanisms have been proposed. But in reality, the program at this point in time has never been fully used or implemented. The next page shows the three cases under which applications have been applied for under the royalty reduction statutes. In 1990, which would have been under the previous program, Conoco applied for Milne Point. The state did a thorough analysis and then denied the application. At that point in time, the Milne Point field was producing about 20,000 barrels per day. Conoco, one of the challenges of this is the individual company's economics vary. Conoco obviously had different economics, not owning part of TAPS, not owning the tanker system, than did other companies. What ended up happening is Conoco at that point, or after that point, ended up selling the field to British Petroleum, and at this point in time, the field has actually almost tripled production. It's producing at 49,000 barrels per day as we speak, up from the 20,000 barrels that Conoco had requested. The analysis of the cost at the time for the royalty reduction would have been about $120 million of lost foregone royalty for the state. So in this case, the application was denied. The field production increased actually over time, and the state would have foregone on the initial production number about $120 million dollars over the life of the field at that time estimated forecasted price. So you can see it's sort of tricky as to whether or not royalty reduction actually changes the physical economics of the field. Conoco claimed it was absolutely necessary. BP came in and actually increased development and enhanced the field and increased production without it. The second case was under the new law, and that was a 1997 application by Unocal for 10 platforms in Cook Inlet. After extensive discussions, the department actually developed a mechanism to grant it for some of those platforms that were, in fact, nearer the economic limit of life and was going to deny it over some that were clearly economic in the state's view. So after a full analysis of that, and I think I have Will Nebeski online, who actually did the economic analysis, and we can talk at greater depth if you want, the state developed a mechanism. Unocal, who was the applicant, decided not to pursue under the mechanism the state proposed, so the application was never finally completed. The third application, I will say all 10 platforms are producing today at pretty similar rates to what they were producing in the third application was for Phillips Petroleum for the Tionic Deep Formation, which underlies the North Cook Inlet gas field. Deeper oil accumulation. It's the Sunfish discovery that you might have heard of in the early 90s. Basically, an application was initiated. Initial review showed great uncertainties with the project in terms of what the capital costs were, what the size of the accumulation was, And Phillips then did not continue to pursue the application because I believe at that point they recognized the royalty reduction wouldn't swing whether or not they would develop it or not. And at this point, the field remains undeveloped. So we have three applications that were initially applied for, one denied, two not completed under the program. So I think from royalty reduction, and Dan Zobrist is also here. He was the commercial analyst that reviewed that data. So if you have specific questions and details on that application, we can Dan would be happy to talk to you, Mr. Chair. The next program I'll talk about are discovery royalty programs. And I think I'm going to reverse the order a little bit. There's actually three cases listed under this. I'll go over the pre-69 leases only statewide program that's listed last. That was a program that was repealed in 1969, but because many of our leases on the North Slope and some of our leases in Cook Inlet were from unitized production where the lease was held for the unit from pre-69, or it was a conditional lease due to land ownership conflicts or unresolved land title issues, but then was later issued, that was initially issued but didn't become an active lease until more recently. There are currently on the North Slope 274 leases eligible for this program, and in Cook Inlet 33 leases. So we have about 300 leases statewide that are still eligible for this program, even though it was repealed almost 30 years ago, over 30 years ago. So it shows you that when you do create an incentive program for the royalty purposes, you generally create a contract right that will exist as long as those leases exist. Under the discovery royalty, in past history, why the program was active and up to current date, we've seen 14 discovery royalties granted, 8 were denied as non-discoveries, and 15 applications were withdrawn or were incomplete. Those withdrawn or incomplete were for discoveries that weren't determined to be at all commercial. And the reason people would apply very early on in the process is you had to, part of the process to grant a discovery royalty was you had to certify the well, and you had to certify it as the first discovery. So if two people were drilling on the same structure, the one that got there first and got sufficient geologic information would get the credit. So in the early days in Cook Inlet, it was often a race between two companies drilling these very large structures. So companies, if they had any doubt at all or any suggestion they had a discovery, they would apply for it. We are still granting these discovery royalties. The most recent one was for the Alpine Field, again on pre-69 leases, even though that was a 1990s discovery, and the Point McIntyre in 1988. To give you an order of magnitude of the cost of these programs, the Point McIntyre, even though it was a 1969 lease, within the Prudhoe Bay unit, the discovery didn't occur until 1988. So very late in the life stage of the lease. So under that program, that is a 10-year period. Discovery royalty, I should say, is granted from the date of first discovery for a 10-year period. It reduces the royalty down to 5% from whatever. Under that program, in a Point McIntyre discovery royalty, the state allowed $50 million in royalty credit for that particular discovery. The Alpine discovery at this point in time is still active, discovery royalty credit, and that has up to date given about $5 million, and we expect to be about $12.5 million projected grant of against the normal royalty. So you can see that these discovery royalties can have very large dollar effects to the royalty stream. Even this existing program still exists, even though repealed in 69, we're still granting it on 30-year-old leases. I think the reason the program was repealed is, in fact, this exact case where discoveries are not, but the program was designed to accelerate exploration and development, and we've seen it now on leases that are 30 to 40 years old in some cases, so it's hard to make the argument, in fact, has accelerated exploration. The same question on the value of the incentive exists in the fact that knocking the royalty down, typically from 12.5% to 5%, has that very limited effect when you look at the cost of development of the field. So in all, even though it's an incentive over, say, in Point Mac over almost 10-year period, it's about $5 million a year. That pales in comparison to the actual cost of developing the field and pales in comparison to the fluctuations in the cost of the commodity. So I think that's my personal belief as to why the program hasn't lived up to being a very effective incentive in the past, in the statewide. So that's the statewide program that was repealed but is still active. We have an additional program in the Cook Inlet Basin for discovery royalty. That program is active. It has no sunset. it somewhat parallels the repeal program, but it has some different caveats. Under the old program, all production from the lease got the credit for the discovery royalty. And if you think about it, that created a difficulty for the state in areas where, like Prudhoe Bay, where there's an existing major field producing, they find a satellite development that overlies or underlies the existing production zone. That discovery royalty credit granted it for all production from the lease. It didn't even require them to produce the satellite field, but they would get production for the main reservoir that's already been producing, in some cases, for 20 or 30 years. So it created a situation that was very, I think, unexpected when the original legislation was passed, but is very real. So when this program was passed, it was limited to the pool of discovery to prevent just that sort of issue from coming up. So you had to actually discover a new pool or a new reservoir of oil and gas, and you only got credit for that new pool. So it limited the right somewhat. It also said that you couldn't get it if it was in 1997 in an existing unit. Again, that recognizing the problem that we're still granting discovery royalties in big units like the Prudhoe Bay unit. So the program was more tailored, more focused, and is in existence today for Cook Inlet Basin only. And you can see it's defined, I believe, as 18, up to 18 township, 18 north, which is actually one township north of our typical area-wide leasing. So that means that program applies not only to our conventional leases, but to a one township-wide band in the exploration license area, and for shallow gas leases that could exist and will exist in that band. So it actually applies in all three cases. The third program was actually near, it's related to the discovery royalty, but in fact is a royalty reduction mechanism that was allowed for six fields in Cook Inlet. And those fields are listed on your sheet, and they are Falls Creek, Nikolai Creek, North Fork, Point Sturichkov, Redoubt Shoals, and West Foreland. So these six fields were not in production at the time. They were discovered in a discovery royalty, a royalty reduction credit of reducing the royalty from the date of first production to 5% was granted for a 10-year period, limited to 25 million barrels of oil or 35 billion cubic feet of gas. So in essence, that program is now being used. Five of those six fields are expected to be in production before the 2004 deadline. The largest one known discovery is the Redoubt Shoal discovery. I should say four are going to be known. Phillips has started the process of suggesting that might occur at Sturisky Point. We don't know that for a fact. They are exploration drilling at this time. So to give you an idea of the magnitude of that, we think at Redoubt Shoals it's worth about $28 million for the 10-year period in that field. So similar large numbers, similar to discovery royalty, and actually probably slightly higher in some cases because discovery royalty was limited from the date of discovery, which then takes you X number of years to get the field online. This is from the date of first production. So you get the full, under this program it was intended that the leases get their full 10 years of production. So anyway, that program exists. Again, we've seen a lot more activity in the Cook Inlet in all six of these areas, and it is quite possible that all six will, in fact, receive some relief under this program. So those are the discovery royalty programs. The last program I want to talk to in the incentives and then go into two of the licensing and shallow gas leasing programs is AS38-05-180AA, and you have a sheet that shows a graph here. This program was a recognition by the legislature that the state's lease terms, which allow the state to get the higher of value, either the actual value of production sold or the higher of value sold in the field or prevailing value for the area for its royalty gas or oil, would be foregone in certain contract cases where there's a contract with a public utility to sell or utility to sell oil and gas. It was a recognition that the producer's contracts with the utilities required, if a higher of value was received, required the utility to pay that or pass that cost on to consumers. So the legislature passed this in order so that did not happen. So it's essentially a reduction in royalty that is passed on to the public utility gas in their gas contract price. The value of that varies depending on the difference between the higher of value and the actual contract price value. You can look at this chart. In 1991, there was a large discrepancy in that. And if you look at the yellow bars on this chart, they reflect the right side of the chart, which shows dollars. And so in 1991, when this was first implemented, the state gave up almost $1.6 million in royalty value. Recently, it's been less than $200,000 because the contract value and the prevailing value or higher of value have narrowed greatly extent. So this is a program that, in fact, has been used. It's been used in Cook Inlet, Beluga River area, but has less and less fiscal effect as gas prices, as contract prices have normalized. The next programs I want to talk to are actually programs of leasings and licensing that the legislature passed. One is exploration licensing. The reason I consider it an incentive program is it foregoes the normal competitive bonus received in a lease sale, allows a company to explore a large amount of acreage, up to 500,000 acres, for the cost of a work commitment. It requires a $1 fee per acre for the licensed area. So if you have a 500,000 acre license, you have to pay the state $500,000 in your application fee. Then that application is noticed, and people compete with how much money they're willing to spend in exploration. So the winning bid in that case is the one that's willing to spend the most in terms of exploration dollars. Then that person gets a right in a negotiated contract to explore for a certain period of time in that licensed area, and they have to expend those dollars in exploration. Under that program, then the person, upon completion of the licensing requirement, may convert to a series of conventional leases without paying a bonus. There's a conversion with a minimum royalty of 12.5% assigned to it. So during the period of the license, there are no rentals paid. And that's significant in the license area. In a 500,000-acre license, if a minimum bid would have been received for that acreage, the incentive over time is worth probably about $10 million for the life of a 7-year license. So, again, I think a very good incentive. This incentive has been actively used and is in the process of use. If you see on the sheet there, we have four licenses that are either issued or pending. One of them in the Copper River Basin is issued. You can see the work commitment's about $1.4 million. It's a relatively short-term, a 5-year license. There are three other licenses pending, two in the Susitna area, and then one in the Nanana Basin. Again, this program was designed to recognize that in some areas, maybe it was more appropriate not to go to the competitive sale, but to a large acreage position to allow a company to leverage and explore in areas that we think are economically more marginal than the typical North Slope or Cook Inlet. Along with this is a full best interest finding and full title work for the land. So administratively, these are very complex programs. Each program has its own environmental mitigation and stipulation measures, which have to be negotiated, et cetera. So these programs, again, I think are primarily designed for interior basin areas. They can't apply to the traditional Cook Inlet or North Slope area-wide sales. So it's limited to a certain number of basins. You can see we have almost 2 million acres tied up in this program, and we look forward to seeing the results of the exploration work, and hopefully we'll stimulate these basins, which are primarily in areas with natural gas potential. The next slide just show you the where these licensed areas are, in Copper River, two in Susitna, and then the two proposed in Susitna and the proposed one in the Fairbanks in the Nanana Basin area. Again, we're very positive on this program. We like it. We think it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. The next program is the Shallow Natural Gas Leasing Program. It was a program that was originally designed and again, came out of this committee. That program is designed to allow for coal bed methane or unconventional or very shallow gas exploration, primarily designed initially for around rural areas where a village might need natural gas. And natural gas is recognized as better than shipping in fuel oil to these village areas. So it was a way for the state to incentivize the areas to try to stimulate exploration activity leading to local energy sources. And particularly with coal bed methane becoming understood and more economic as the equipment and technology for completion got better, it was try to stimulate that activity in Alaska. The program initially started with the concept of being just around local village areas, but now has been greatly expanded to the areas in the Mat-Su Valley, northern Mat-Su Valley, down by Homer, in the Fairbanks Big Delta area, and then over by the Red Dog Mine area, the Cameco development area. So in a nutshell, this program allows you to lease non-competitively. In other words, go in an area and stake an area and file for an application. The first application to the area is examined. The leases can be up to 3 mile by 3 mile, so large leases. The only fee right now is a $500 fee of application. Once the lease is issued, it has a 50 cent per year rental. It's only for rights above 3,000 feet and only for gas. The program, again, has come very large. There's over 1 million acres in leased and pending leased acreage, over 300-some leases. There's a bill currently, SB 319, to amend the program. We strongly support these amendments. Senator Torgerson's bill, it's, I guess, coming before this committee. We think it takes the program from what was designed to be a small local energy program into a full-fledged commercial program, recognizing the potential of this program. And it provides additional environmental protections for the state, as well as additional revenue, as well as significant additional rights to the lessees. And we believe the lessees, the people involved in this program, now strongly support the changes to the program. So we look forward to this committee hearing Senator Torgerson's bill, SB 319. But in essence, this program is very robust at this point in time. Evergreen Resources, pretty much a world-class coalbed methane company, is, as stated several times, they have come to Alaska because of this program. So again, we see this program actually working toward the potential development of gas, particularly in the Fairbanks and in the Matsu area, and potentially down near in the Homer area. It also looks like it has the potential to work in the Kotzebue area with the Red Dog mine, where it's not actually coalbed methane, but fractured shales they're looking at. So this program is a non-competitive, very low entry fees into the program, and basically an over-the-counter leasing. So we consider incentive because our typical leasing program would have a bonus bid that we're willing to forego in order to get the program in, and the lease rental payments, either under the new or the old program, are much lower than on a conventional lease. Also, this does not require a best interest finding, so in theory, the leases can be issued faster.
Very good. Are there any questions from Mr. Myers? Yes, Representative Coring.
Floyd, in regard to the coalbed methane activities and so forth, I'm just wondering what's happening in terms of rural Alaska. You had talked about the Matsu and the Kenai Peninsula and the Red Dog area as far as there being a lot of leasing activity and so forth. Is there anything happening in the other rural parts of the state that might show some good potential? Because I know one of the intents of Representative Hogan's legislation years ago was to do something to minimize the dependence on the PCE program that rural Alaska had to help solve their energy sources, their energy needs.
Representative, according to the chair, if you look at the map behind you of the blue state lands, one of the issues of near these rural energy areas, how much land does the state have that's geologically appropriate for coalbed methane? And unfortunately, when you look at it, there aren't a lot of areas, I believe, where the state actually owns land near villages that has the potential coals at the right depths for this program to work. You know, the screening says that you need a community of a certain size as well. So you combine all those things. There just hasn't been lease applications for these areas, either because the economics aren't right or the geology isn't right or the state doesn't own the land. So I think when you look at it with a critical view, I think the program for those villages is good, but I think it's going to have limited application on state lands. If you look around the villages, commonly the land is owned by the native corporations and the subsurface rights are. Not to say there aren't some cases where this might work, like the Fort Yukon area or a few places where it might work. But in general, I think, you know, the program's been in existence. We've seen the pattern of application. No one has applied. It's been freely available. And I think the reason is those other purposes, either that the village sizes aren't large enough to present an economic target or the land isn't owned by the state in these areas.
If in looking at these, Mark, if you were to repeal any of these because of the cost to the state, would you? Are there any here that you might want to repeal because of what you think are the costs?
Well, I guess I'm purely a much. If I were to repeal, it would be the discovery royalty. I think the royalty reduction is an appropriate mechanism. It's a very, you know, got a limited utility, but is very appropriate. And there are cases I think where the state will want to do royalty reduction, the benefits. So. I would not want to repeal the royalty reduction. I have no problems with the exploration incentive credit programs. Two reasons. One is they are targeted directly at exploration. They can make a significant difference, and they are discretionary. So the state can use its good judgment on those programs. Discovery royalty incentive, I think, over time has proven it's not a good incentive. For at least it hasn't stimulated or accelerated exploration, in my opinion. So Discovery Royalty would be the one I would target, the Cook Inlet Discovery Royalty, quite honestly.
Right.
That would be the only one.
And I ask that because of the numerous potential basins in the state. And even though this is specific to the Cook Inlet, those other basins, if this were left, I would expect they would also want a discovery royalty incentive too, which is leveling the playing field. So whether or not we repeal it or not is a question, but I do thank you for your analysis of that. Any other questions? Very good. I really appreciate it. It's been a very, very good overview on this, and I'm sorry that some of the other members here had to run off, and they're coming back and running forward and scurrying all over the place. And so with that, we'll have Commissioner Condon come up, and he lost a flip of the coin.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wilson Condon. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. I apologize at the outset here for not having any handout material, but I don't. With respect to the tax taxes that are on the books, with respect to the oil and gas industry, we don't have, you have not put in place anything that one might characterize as an incentive program. But nevertheless, as is always the case, you know, any tax system has incentives and disincentives. Some of those are intended and some of them are not. But I think we ought to stop for just a minute and at least when we're talking about taxes, talk about what we mean by an incentive. For my purposes this morning, I'm going to use the term with the following meaning. It's a provision in tax legislation that influences the behavior of the taxpayer. While taxes almost always create incentives of some kind, some of them are intended by the legislature when they enact or amend a tax statute, and some of them are obviously unintended. Rather than go through all of the tax provisions applicable to the oil and gas industry and analyze them for intended and unintended incentives, I just want to point out three provisions the tax program as it applies to the oil and gas industry that you have consciously put in place to affect the behavior of taxpayers. The first incentive that I want to talk about is the basic tax rate for oil production. Today, that a basic tax rate is 12.25% of the value of production in the field during the first 5 years of production. And after 5 years of production, the tax rate is 15%. Now, that's the provision I want to talk about, but I think it's also an appropriate time to also tell you what the gas tax rate for the production tax is, and that is it's 10%. Of the value of production for the life of production. Now, the 12.25% rate escalating to 15 after 5 years was enacted in 1981. Prior to that time, the oil tax rate was 12.25%. And when the tax rate was raised from 12.25% to 15%, the legislature kept it at 12.25% for the first 5 years, because they did not want to discourage investment in new fields as much as they felt raising the tax rate to 15% would discourage investment in new fields. Now, you ask the question, does it do what it's supposed to do? Well, it's absolutely clear that holding the tax rate down to 12.25% for 5 years rather than putting it on the books at 15% for those 5 years is going to improve the projected economics of any new large development, the development that's occurred at Alpine and North Star recently. But again, you have to ask yourselves, what the trade-off is between prospective investment and development and the tax rate that's on the books. But again, obviously, the reason that the legislature structured the tax rate as it did for oil at 12.25% for the first 5 years of production and 15% thereafter was simply a judgment about what kind of incentives and disincentives taxes played in investing in oil and gas development. There are two different incentives that the legislature had in mind with respect to something that gets talked about often as we talk about oil and gas taxation, and that's the economic limit factor, or the ELF. And the first objective that the legislature had in mind when they structured the tax as they did and put the ELF in place was what they wanted to do was make sure that the tax did not cause production to be shut in because of the tax. And so as a property reached it near the end of its economic life, they wanted to structure the tax so that the tax rate fell to zero so that the cost of the tax would not be the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak, in terms of ending the life of a producing property. And the way that the legislature did that when they first put the ELF on the books in 1977 was to base the ELF on the per well productivity rate of a field. And so as the production rate fell, either for an oil field or for a gas field, the ELF was designed so that when the per well productivity from that field dropped below a certain point, the tax rate would go to zero. And conversely, when the production rate on a per well basis was relatively high, then the tax rate would be at or near, very near the nominal rate that is provided for, which, as I said, prior to 1981 was 12.25% for oil, and after 1981 was 12.25% for the first 5 years of an oil field's life and 15% thereafter. And for gas, the nominal rate was 10%. And then, again, as you neared the end of a field's life and the per well productivity dropped, the ELF had the effect of taking the tax rate for oil from 15% on down to zero, depending on the per well productivity. And the same thing was true for gas. The ELF was changed by the legislature in 1989, and one of the objectives that the legislature had in mind in making that change, not the only objective, but the one that you would characterize as an incentive, was to add a provision and into the ELF, which added the overall productivity of the field into the ELF formula, so that the ELF formula was a product of both per well productivity and the overall production level from a producing field. And the reason for adding this provision into the ELF was primarily to change the tax rate and a profile for highly productive fields and to increase the tax rate on those fields, but also with respect to fields which were small, to lower the tax rate on an overall basis for small producing fields, that is oil fields. And the reason that the legislature did that was to encourage the development of smaller oil accumulations. And again, there's no question that by lowering the tax rate on smaller accumulations, it does have some effect on the economics of producing smaller fields, and at the margin, it's going to have some effect on investment in those smaller fields and the development of those smaller fields. And the certainly the taxpayers tell us that the development of, of what we call the satellite fields on the North Slope today is made more economic by the manner in which the ELF has been constructed. So with respect to or encourage certain kinds of taxpayer behavior, the 12.25% for the first 5 years, going up to 15% provision on the oil tax, was structured that way with the hopes that the tax increase that was put on the books for the production tax in 1981 would not discourage, overly discourage, new investment. The ELF was put in place and structured as it was so that the tax would not lead to the premature shut-in of production. The ELF was restructured in 1989 to lighten, in part, to lighten the tax burden on small oil accumulations with the hope that it would make it more likely that those oil accumulations would be developed. And so that's the series of policy choices that the legislature has made in structuring the tax program to influence the behavior of the taxpayers. I might say just a couple of other things that about the state's fiscal system overall. The one thing that we don't do across the board is to recognize in our tax system and our royalty system, although we do to some degree in the royalty system, but we certainly don't in the tax system, we don't recognize new investment in Alaska in arriving at the tax level, the level of state take from oil and gas production operations. And we certainly do live in a competitive world, and we're, as a consequence of the way the oil and gas industry has evolved, we do compete against other areas in the world for capital dollars. And with the emergence of the super major oil companies as a consequence of mergers and the opening of countries that were not open before, but with the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the investment opportunities that have become available in that part of the world, we certainly face a more competitive situation as a taxing entity than we did a decade ago. And capital investment is clearly necessary on an ongoing basis to maximize production from currently producing fields, to develop discovered but not yet developed resources, and to discover new resources. And if a company invests its dollars in Alaska as opposed to Kazakhstan, we don't take that into account in the level of our level of fiscal take through our tax system. And many other areas in the world do take into account new investments in figuring the tax obligation of firms engaged in the oil and gas industry and their jurisdiction. And that is something we ought to think about, because today, having been placed in a situation where we're competing against investment opportunities in other jurisdictions in the world, if other jurisdictions have structured their fiscal system so that they take into account investment there, and we do not, it does place us in a competitive disadvantage if all of the things are equal in terms of cost, geologic prospectivity, and so on. And so that is certainly one aspect of our tax system that I think we want to think about as time marches on.
Okay, are there any questions of the commissioner? You know, on that last point, the competition that you've mentioned, wouldn't that tend to, competition being what it is, wouldn't that tend to seesaw downward? In other words, you get into a competitive shooting match, and if you get into that competition with, as you also mentioned, some of these other areas, whether they be the old boundaries of the Soviet Union or wherever in the world, and they can not only match our potential in hydrocarbons, but maybe even, and certainly it's shown, may surpass it. Wouldn't that be an uneven competitive match as it seesaws downward? Wouldn't
it can be, Mr. Chair, and but that's the world as it exists today. You know, we do have to be concerned about a race to the bottom, so to speak. But I don't think there's anything we can do about that. I do think that when we look at our own tax system, we have to ask ourselves whether we should be imposing the same tax obligation on a firm that makes money here and then reinvests that money here, as opposed to a firm that makes money here and takes that money and invests it in Kazakhstan. And you know, you are correct that we could become the victims of a competitive race to the bottom, so to speak. But our entry into that race, I don't think, accelerates the downward speed. You know, we are looking at that. You know, the possibility and the reality of that to some degree on a worldwide basis.
But would you advise basing our royalties and taxes on the supposition that just because other nations that you have described also give some incentive, would you also begin to give that incentive and hence start that competitive downward?
I don't think our entry changes. I mean, I think that competitive downward pressure exists in the world today. I think our entry into that arena doesn't change materially the downward pressure that's already in the picture. But I do think we ought to think about whether with respect to our tax system, ought to be structured in a way so that the tax burden is the same for someone who reinvests all their profits here in Alaska as opposed to someone who takes all their profits and invests them elsewhere.
Any questions from the... Yes,
just want to make an observation. If we end up in a downward spiral or downward movement as far as the competition in the world, we need to be aware of the fact that more royalties to the state treasury is not necessarily the only thing we should be looking at, but the economic growth through exploration and development in the industry that would result in more jobs, more dollars flowing in the private sector economy. So there's certainly a benefit in having that exploration, even if the royalties are less, I guess is my point, because we're talking economic growth, development, and that helps to bolster our economy and provide those jobs. So it shouldn't just be the emphasis on the one thing, and that is royalties to the state. It should be the overall benefit to the economy.
Good point. Good point. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Well, if not, thank you, Commissioner Common.
My apologies for not bringing you copies of the ELF formula.
Well, that's good because it did open the door to some discussion that has been a real concern of mine, and that is the competition that we face. And, of course, Russia does not belong to OPEC, and its potential is huge, and there can be competition, not just with us, with other nations, but as far as the pricing of oil and gas, there could be competition between the OPEC countries and other producers, which would also suppress or depress the price of oil and gas. So we're looking at a very complex mixture here of not only the capital, as you suggest, the capital that we would like to retain or bring in more of into the state of Alaska for exploration and development, but also the pricing structure as a result of the competition among the OPEC nations or non-OPEC nations themselves. So with that, once again, we thank you, and if any of you have any more comments, well, I'd like to hear it right now. We've got a good time, and we have another bill to bring up, but it's been done very well, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Yes, Mark.
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like a comment or two on some things we might do.
Great. I'd like to hear it.
Mr. Chairman, I think one of the great things Alaska has is geologic potential, and the more we do to promote that, to get the education out there to companies, and not just the large multinationals, the mid-sized companies, the mid-sized exploration companies, which would, in the old days probably would have been a small major, but now compared to the super majors are small, and the more independent companies, the more we normalize our industry. If you look historically as basins are developed, large majors take the first step. And then as the basin matures, you see more and more entries of smaller companies that once the basic infrastructure is there, that can move a little quicker and a little more inexpensively, have better economics, in fact. But they have to change things around quickly. They have to make money, the rate of return, quicker. They can't wait 10 years for their production to come online. They need to get it in 3 or 4 years, et cetera. We're starting to see folks on the edge coming in. It's very positive, as well as some other majors like Shell and Unocal back exploring on the slope, the Anadarkos, the AECs of the world coming in and being fairly aggressive and bullish on Alaska's North Slope. We're seeing smaller companies like Pelican Hills come into the Cook Inlet, Armstrong Resources buying leases on the North Slope. I think the more we can do to encourage these companies, the better off we'll be. So there's some things that aren't strictly monetary, but that the quality of our leasing program, our ability to turn leases around, we're taking 14 months to issue a lease now, that's problematic. We need to be able to accelerate our leasing program. We need to make sure that our title work is great and all our our permitting processes work smoothly in terms of accelerating exploration developing and lowering their risk of project delay. And then finally, again, I think the infrastructure on the North Slope needs to be open for all parties, and that includes pipelines and facilities. The facility sharing agreements need to be efficient and work so that new parties can come in and have excess capacities available in facilities that it is, in fact, available for other companies to come in. So there's lots of areas outside of strict fiscal incentives, I think, where the state can work and improve, and we are striving at. And if we do those things, I think, in addition, we can bring in additional new players to the North Slope. They may not be the large super majors, but they will be the next kind of tier of companies that you would expect as sedimentary basins mature and infrastructure develops.
That's good. Well, any way we can help you, and as Representative Coring mentioned, this is the very heart of the economy that we've all been searching for. We need more than just oil and gas, but it could certainly be the stimulus that provides that. So,
Mr. Chairman, I think
anything we can do to help, why?
The exploration licensing, the shallow gas leasing, all those aren't huge dollars to the state, but they bring in this infrastructure you're discussing and bring in jobs, create revenue in general for the public. So I think the right resources in the agencies to manage that as well, and you guys have been very supportive of our budget process. I appreciate that very much. That's a significant part of our ability to manage the program.
Well, thank you very much. And if there's no more comment or questions, we'll take just a short at ease here while we change the tapes, and then we'll take up HB 302.